When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music monthly. I'm Freya Parr, the magazine's digital editor and staff writer, and this week I'm speaking to the British clarinetist Julian Bliss. Despite being only in his early 30s, Bliss has been on the classical music circuit for several decades already, thanks to a very early start. As well as a successful solo career, he's also launched the Julian Bliss Septet, with whom he performs jazz-infused works by the likes of Gershwin and Benny Goodman. During lockdown, Bliss has released a series of EPs produced from his home in Hertfordshire, including a multi-tracking project with percussionist Joby Burgess. His new album of Brahms clarinet sonatas is out now on Signum Classics. We spoke via Zoom towards the end of the UK lockdown. Julian started off telling me a little bit about his home recording studio where he was talking to me from.
So in terms of microphones, I ended up with two pairs of microphones, some by Royer, which I love, the ribbon microphones, and then some Sherps, which I don't think I've ever done a recording where, well, very rarely that there hasn't been Sherps microphones. They're so popular and so good. Then got an audio interface, recording to Logic, got a pair of monitors, then acoustic panels for the room, and yeah.
Wow. Okay. You went all in then.
I did. Well, the way I saw it, I was like, well, it's an investment. That's how I told myself. It's okay. It's an investment. Well, the thing is, they'll probably last longer than my playing career, really. Got my own place like 12 years ago. And I think this is the most time I've ever spent here, ever. It's really...
What was your first interactions with music? I know you've been playing. I actually know... very intimately, because I went down a YouTube rabbit hole yesterday.
Oh, no.
And then, if that was correct, why were you playing Gershwin on ITV at the age of five?
I come from predominantly a non-musical family, and I don't really know where it came from, but one day I decided that I wanted to play music. And I told my parents this, and at the age of four, I mean, you know, you do tend to change your mind quite a lot when you're a kid. And I think they thought it was one of those passing things, and, you know, I'd be on to the next thing that I wanted or next toy that I wanted. But that didn't happen. And I carried on nagging my parents every single day until finally they gave in and handed me a recorder, which I played for a little bit. And then I gave it back. The story goes, I gave them the recorder back and I told them that I wanted to play something else. But with no real experience of any musical instruments, I knew it would be a wind or brass instrument. And I don't know why. And I remember being in the music shops and trying all sorts of different instruments. And my parents took me to a place called Musicale, Harpen and Musicale, which, I mean, fantastic music school. They do a huge amount for music for young people and youth orchestras. And they had all the instruments there, and I just tried everything. And I remember one day in particular, just before the clarinet, they brought out a cello. And I tried the cello. It's okay for me. I mean, cello is a fantastic instrument, don't get me wrong. And then they brought out this plastic clarinet. And when I say plastic, I mean entirely plastic. All the keys and, yeah, the pads were made from rubber. Very, very durable. Which is perfect for when you're only four. But they brought this out and showed me how to play a couple of notes, and I was hooked. That was it. I decided. And I don't know whether having the thought that it would be a wind or brass instrument, if I already knew the kind of sound I wanted to make, I could hear it in my mind, but didn't know what instrument made that sound. I don't know. But yeah, there was no looking back. None at all. I remember, it's weird what you remember from when you're very, very little. And one thing I do remember is being in the car on the way home, having just got my clarinet. And I was in the back playing just the mouthpiece. Terrible. And I think it probably at that time they thought, what have we done? We've messed up. We've made a mistake here. But and of course, when you're that age, you don't think about what you're going to do when you grow up. You don't think about a career. You don't. That never even enters your mind. It was just what I enjoyed doing more than anything else, really. Then I realized, I think by the time I realized I wanted to do this as a career, in some ways I kind of already was. I just didn't realize that I could turn this thing I enjoyed doing into a career. And that's really nice that I was able to do that.
So when you were age four, when you first decided that you wanted to play music in whatever capacity, had there been music around you? Had you heard music? What kind of sparked that initial interest?
Well, my old brother played the French horn, so there was music in the house, and we did have a piano in the house. But there was no, that was about it, really. No one else in the family was musical at all. Majority of the family, my dad, for example, is a motorcycle mechanic and buys and sells bikes. And and even my younger brother had absolutely no interest in music at all. Creative still, though. He was very into art and now is in film and writing and all of that side. So we ended up all kind of artistic in some ways, but yeah, I was the only one that ended up pursuing music. So there was some music around, but majority of the family predominates none at all. So
at what point did you, because often when you start playing music, you play what you're given, and you then develop certain things that you're interested in terms of musical styles or anything like that. What was the first piece of music or area of music that particularly interested you?
Well, going by the, for me, fairly, I wouldn't say they're embarrassing, but they kind of look back on them with a smile. Those videos from when I was very young, playing on TV, and it's hilarious to now look at it and remember those things. Like the one I played, Summertime, I remember that really well. And I distinctly remember just not being nervous at all, which, now looking back, I mean, maybe I should have been. It's like my first time ever playing on TV and a big TV audience. But I think when you're that age, you're kind of fearless, and nobody ever told me that I should be nervous, and nobody ever told me about the things that could go wrong. To me, I guess it was quite simple. There was this thing, I'd learned to play the piece, and then my teacher said, can you play it in front of these people? And I thought, yeah, okay, why not? And the fact there was all these people looking at me, it didn't faze me at all. And I just kind of enjoyed it. And I mean, I ended up doing quite a handful of those TV shows back then, and it was always a huge amount of fun. But yeah, the repertoire was kind of varied, especially at that age. I mean, there was, Gershwin. And I mean, of course I had to, and one I played, Stranger on the Shore. I mean, you can't not, can you? I think it was the Des O'Connor show with Akerbilk himself, and we played Stranger on the Shore together, which was, and his band. It was a huge amount of fun. I mean,
is this still on YouTube?
It is. Yeah, it is. Okay, still good. On YouTube. And I think you can see as I'm playing, I'm just kind of looking around the room. I should be concentrating. I mean, I was concentrating, but it looks like I'm somewhere else, completely somewhere else. Yeah. But the repertoire was fairly varied. And then as I started to get older, of course, you know, most of what I studied and learned was based in the classical world. And so kind of clearly went down that path. And I never really thought about, well, for many years, never thought about playing jazz. And I guess the first time I really heard heard jazz was, I was on a trip to the US and I picked up a CD of Benny Goodman's playing. And I mean, of course, I loved it. I thought it was awesome. But it was kind of seemed quite far away from the way I was playing. And I guess I didn't make that connection and didn't think, it just didn't enter my mind as to I want to do jazz as well at that point. And it wasn't until many, many years later. But yeah, I guess in the beginning it was somewhat of the lighter side of, I mean, what do you categorize Stranger on the Shore as, is it? I don't know. Yeah, well, it was incredibly popular. It was very popular and people loved it. So that's all that matters, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So this podcast is particularly about your listening habits and how your listening might have changed throughout your career. At what point did you start listening to classical music and or jazz or anything like that, as well as playing it as a musician?
So with the classical side of things, kind of as far back as I can remember, then started to listen. And I would always, I wouldn't necessarily say relied on my ears, but I think my ears were my strongest musical thing. And I've always tried to listen as much as I can, listen to recordings, listen to other people, but also myself and others when I'm working with them. I think, yeah, that tends to be my strongest tool, if you like. But I always, if I was learning a piece, I could always learn it so much better if I listened to recordings. And I always would memorize music as well. I still do, but I could memorize something so much better by if I could hear it over and over again, rather than just looking at it on a page. I think that's how I would always learn best. And I think it's really a really good thing to do as anyone is learning a piece of music, to listen to as many different recordings as you possibly can. First of all, to learn the music, to get an idea of how it goes, the shape, not just what you're playing, but what else is going on at the same time. But also to identify things you like in the interpretation, but also things that you don't like. And that's fine. I mean, not everyone is going to have the same opinions. And I think if you, as a musician, if you try and actively quantify what it is you like, whether it's a certain type of phrasing or the way that they articulate certain notes or dynamics, but also quantify what maybe, I wouldn't say what you don't like, but what you wouldn't do, that then makes your playing, makes you a better musician, more aware musician. So I always, yeah, I remember music being on all the time. And for some reason, the one piece that I remember from my childhood a lot is Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto. I don't know if it was on once or twice or more, but I had a chance to study at the junior college for a number of years, and my mum would very kindly, as she drove me all over the country and flew with me all over the world, I wouldn't have been able to do any of this without her. I remember that piece being on, and distinctly remember driving through Hyde Park listening to Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto. I don't know why. It's really weird what you remember and what music, what memories music can invoke. But I always remember listening to that piece. So yeah, music was on all the time, and especially my mum, who did spend a lot of time with me, she kind of had to learn all about it too. So, and I back then, I don't know how eclectic my musical taste was. I did listen to, I've always listened to a lot of piano music, because at the same time of starting the clarinet, I also started piano, and I always really, really loved the piano. And I think it was as I got older, my musical tastes kind of got a bit wider, if you like.
So with the Tchaikovsky, is that still a piece that really captures your imagination? Or was it, I think, obviously there's a lot going on, I guess, for a kid as well, that would be particularly imaginative. How do you feel listening to it these days?
Ah, it's awesome. I love it. simple answer. No, it's such incredible writing. And I always like listening to it and different interpretations as well. I think now, though, from that, I kind of evolved and then I found, it sounds crazy to say I found them, but because I discovered for myself back then Rachmaninoff piano concertos. And that was like a whole new thing. I think Rachmaninoff's my favorite composer. I really do. I could listen to his compositions all day, every day. Him and Oscar Peterson, and well, maybe a couple of others. Anyway, we won't. Now you think about it. Oh well. But I don't know. There's something about Rachmaninoff's writing. It's just right. It just works. It's just so. It invokes so many different emotions and feelings and images, and yeah, I think one of the reasons I always loved those piano concertos is secretly I wished I could play them myself. And I still have this kind of lofty ambition that one day I'm going to learn Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto. I mean, I would just love to be able to sit down and play that. And also there's a cadenza at the end. I think it's the end of the first movement of Rack 1 that is just the most incredible cadenza. Like, I want to play that. That's what I want to do. But then I think, and actually, yeah, piano's always been there, because most of the jazz that I listen to is very piano-centric. I mean, I mentioned Oscar Peterson, and he was one. I often put Oscar Peterson on shuffle and I would just leave it for hours. And again, I was trying to explain it to someone the other day, and the only way I could come up with it's just so right. It just works. The articulation, the phrasing, the nuance, the everything, it's just there. And he's one of the most incredible musicians. And yeah, it's funny how when you actually think about it, how piano is always kind of very, very centric.
What do your listening habits on a day-to-day basis look like generally? How do you listen?
It does vary. My listening habits have changed. And I will always, I do find, I like putting on music and then doing emails and doing admin. And I think actually that the amount of that side of work has increased in the last year. Yeah. But I always find myself getting distracted. If I put something on that's really good, then I kind of start paying too much attention to that and not what I'm actually doing. So I often try and put something like that on, nothing too involved. Like, I wouldn't put a Rachmaninoff piano concerto on when I'm trying to send some emails and administration stuff. Maybe some kind of slower jazz or something like that. But the times I would really listen to music would be when I was in the car driving to various concerts, and that's kind of all changed. So yeah, I think I don't know the last time I actually sat down and focused on a recording that wasn't something that I had to focus on, you know, an album that we were, you know, a first mix that I'd received and we had to listen to it to give our thoughts. But yeah, it's always whilst you're doing other things. And I think that time, and also when I would travel on planes, I'd always have music on, and I'd just sit there and listen to whatever took my fancy. And so I think that has kind of changed. Maybe I need to get back to that. Just put something on and sit there with a nice glass of wine or something. That sounds good.
That sounds very civilized.
It does.
What are those albums that you reach for when you want something to just sit in the background slightly and not take over?
I think there's an Oscar Peterson, I think it's called We Take Requests, that is, I think that's awesome, incredible. Nancy Wilson and Cannibal Adderley is also, I mean, that she just has the most amazing voice. So pure, so much. I don't know, you can almost feel the, like the, or sense the vulnerability in her voice, if that makes sense. And yes, the other band members, it's really sensitive playing, and it just kind of draws you in, very intimate kind of feel.
Your eyes don't shine like they used to shine and the thrill is gone.
Often now, I mean, we live in a day where listening to a whole recording from start to finish is, for some people, a bit of a novel idea now, with playlists and with discovering a lot of music, and we listen in a different way. Like I said, I will put Oscar Peterson on shuffle, and then there's some archive live recordings, there's some studio recordings, and the time periods can vary wildly. And I think I do the same with, if it's Rachmaninoff or any other composer as well. So I think instead of listening to full albums now, I will either go and search out an individual piece, and then, I mean, the great thing about all of these streaming services is you find hundreds of recordings of certain pieces, and often I will go through and find the one that I like in terms of sometimes recording style, tempo, feel, dynamics, and yeah, this, we're almost really spoilt for choice. So yeah, I don't know the last time. I don't even have a CD player. I mean, that sounds ridiculous to say. I think what I would love to, I mean, there's lots of things that I would like to have in life. But one of the things I would really like at some point is a very high quality hi-fi system with a very good CD player and a good somewhere to play vinyl, and just ideally just a room in the house that's set up perfectly for listening. And yeah, that would be really nice, because you then could go in and focus on the music that you're listening to. I used to think, but I remember I was at someone's house, and they put on a Tower of Power album, and they had an incredible setup. And I shut my eyes, and it was like they were in front of me. It was so powerful. And it was one of those, I thought, yeah, I want that. That sounds cool. You know, it's a different way, rather than, and you never get the same quality listening through laptop speakers it's very difficult. And it's difficult for us as well, creating music that we know are going to be listening to on headphones, speakers, in the car, trying to make it work for all of those applications too. So
how do you do that? How do you try and cater to all those different listening styles?
It's a real art, the mixing and mastering. And I always knew it was, but have realized that even more through lockdown. And I've done some recording myself at home, some multi-track EPs, which... Yeah, and one of them, I think there's 35 clarinet parts. Can you imagine?
All played 30, by you?
All played by me.
Wow, sure.
And there'll be, you know, trying different things, like trying to find a contrabass clarinet, which is huge. And I hadn't really played one much before, and I thought, well, now's a good time to learn. And or screeching away on the E-flat clarinet at 1:30 in the morning, just because you get in the mood and you get in the mindset of doing it, and you look at the clock, think, oh, I don't know how my neighbours will feel about this. They said they couldn't hear it, which was great.
Anyway, good soundproofing.
Yeah. Or they've just tuned it out at this point. Probably that one. But to then record at home and then edit it all myself and then do some of the mixing, I've realized it takes years and years worth of experience. And there are some, I'm very lucky for most of my recordings work with a guy called Mike Hatch, who in that world is just known. I think he's the busiest guy I know. I've never met anyone so busy. He's
highly sought after.
Oh, incredibly. But a wide array of different types of recordings. I mean, we did a recording of Mozart clarinet quintet. And I think then he went straight off after that to do all of the sound for a Lady Gaga gig. You know, that kind of, yeah, incredibly versatile. But yeah, he's on the team at Signum, Floating Earth Signum Records. I mean, well, he is part of that. And so I'm very lucky to work with him. So yeah, he would take care of all of the sound. I just have to worry about playing the right notes at the right time. But yeah, in these times, having recorded myself, I certainly got a lot of advice from him. And I'm hoping, I think this EP is going to be out in June. It's with percussion. There's some percussion parts as well. And the incredible Joby Burgess, who also has a bit of a home studio. And you know what is really fascinating, though, is when you're in isolation, recording one part, and then over time, you hear it all start to come together, and then you put on the percussion parts and it sounds, you get this whole new sound and you think, wow, we did this remotely. It's quite incredible, actually. It was a huge amount of fun, and I want to do more, actually.
Yeah. Is that something you arranged yourself then, the piece that you've recorded together?
So I did three pieces. It's something that in this country, well, I guess it's the differences, country differences. These are American band composers, and the band world in the US is huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't do it justice. It's incredible. And these three composers, I mean, Eric Whitaker, John Mackey, and Frank Tichelli. Anybody that was in a band or choir in the US at any point will know these three names. They would have played or heard or sung these pieces, so they're incredibly well known. And for some reason I thought, I want to play these all on clarinet, and I don't think I've been done quite in this way before. The piece by John Mackey, a piece called Asphalt Cocktail, has been arranged for saxophone ensemble, so something similar has been done before, but the other two I don't think have been done in this way. Maybe there's a reason I haven't realized yet. I hope they sound good. I think everyone can be the judge of that when they're released. But it's such a huge and rich world. The American band world is incredible. And having been involved in that side of things more over the last 10 years, yeah, it was a natural choice to do those three. And so yeah, it's a little bit different. And maybe some people over here, I would imagine, haven't heard some of those pieces. So it might be something new for them, which is also really, really nice.
Is that a kind of area of music that you've listened to a lot in the past, or is that a new discovery for you?
It all started when I started working with Conselmer and LeBlanc, Conselmer is part of Steinway. So one of the largest musical instrument manufacturers, and LeBlanc make clarinets and have done for a very long time. And so starting to work with them and then going out and doing a lot of masterclasses and working with students in middle school and high school who were in band, from that I was kind of immersed in that world and really saw how powerful music was in education in America. It's so, in some schools, so ingrained. I mean, the performing arts centers they have are bigger than some of our concert halls. You think, wait, this is a high school. Come on, you know, the most elaborate halls with you know, raising pits, and it's incredible. You think, whoa. They take such pride in it. And some of the band classes start at like 7:30 in the morning. I mean, that is dedication.
Yeah.
I don't think I know what a clarinet is at 7:30 in the morning. But it was through that, and then going to a lot of the large conventions that I started to hear a lot of that music, and then was asked to play some of the pieces that have been arranged or written, the concertos. And so, yeah, then started to understand it and know those composers a lot more. And it's a really interesting sound world. Mm-hmm. I mean, wind bands is not, it's not a US only thing. There are incredible wind bands across Europe. And over here, we have a huge history for brass bands, which is, I think the UK is known for that. But wind ensembles are across the whole world, really. But there is something special about the US way of doing it. So, yeah, probably the last 15 years, and especially in the last five, as I've started to think about commissioning a concerto, which I have done now. John Mackey is going to write me a clarinet concerto, which is going to be, I can't wait. I cannot wait. It's going to be awesome. But there's some really, really excellent music. Really excellent. I would encourage anybody to check it out, and some really incredible wind ensembles as well.
Yeah, I agree. I'm really into wind band music, but I do think over here in the UK, it's not looked down on, but I think it's slightly cast aside, as maybe because, like you say, it's not so much of a thing. Why do you think that is? It's not considered this in the same realm as orchestral.
Yeah, you're right. And I don't really know. Yeah, it is certainly seen as different, and we don't tend to have as many wind ensembles here. I mean, we have a huge amount of orchestras, actually, more than other countries. I'm not sure, really. Maybe, that's a really interesting question. And I would like to bring it here more and for more people to be involved in it. Maybe it's something that for a lot of the repertoire, a vast amount of the repertoire we learn is for orchestra. And there is no doubt that you get from strings, you do get a different kind of sound than you do from only winds. But when you put a whole wind ensemble together, if they're a very good one and they play very well together, it's a kind of unbeatable sound. I guess in some ways, because you have a lot of the same kind of timbre of sound, and differences, it's all and the breathing and everything is the same, often the same kind of attack, that you end up with this new sound rather than it sounding like a bunch of different instruments put together. And I'm not saying orchestras sound like that at all, by the way. I realized that as I said it. But I mean, those three I mentioned, so Eric Whitaker, John Mackey, Frank Tekeli, three of the greats. There's a guy at the moment who's really, really popular called Omar Thomas, who's in composing some awesome music. A lot of it, or some of it, takes a lot of inspiration from jazz as well. Jennifer Higdon as well. She's written some incredible compositions. I mean, and the list goes on. It's a very rich world, and one I really enjoy it.
Have you ever played Equus by Eric Whitaker?
I haven't, actually. It was a really, really good piece. I listened to it quite a bit. I mean, Eric's a really diverse composer, and his core works are utterly beautiful, incredible writing, and then his wind ensemble works as well are equally as great. And Equus is a really, really good piece. I really like that one. It might be one. Maybe I should try and do a clarinet version of that. Man, that would be. There's a lot of repeated notes, isn't there? I remember that bit.
Maybe if we go into a fourth lockdown, you might consider it.
Please no. I mean, I want to record it, but I don't want a fourth lockdown.
That's a good moment, actually, to move on to a slightly tortured subject at the moment, because it's a bit alien, is live music. How much physical in-person performing have you been able to do this year, if any?
Yeah, not much. Some people really enjoy, and by me saying this doesn't mean I don't, but some people really enjoy the whole practicing and preparation side. But for me, the bit I look forward to the most is the performance. It's that adrenaline rush. I love being in front of an audience and sharing music and kind of getting excited and taking inspiration and, yeah, pushing yourself. So that's what I've always gone for. And then when you're practicing and that isn't there anymore, it's kind of, you kind of feel a bit lost. And so even the way I practice and the way has really changed quite significantly. The other thing that has been difficult is a lot of it I leave for the performance. A lot of the interpretation, the if we're going to take time here or dynamics. And when you work with other musicians like that, that's when it comes alive. And the audience can notice that. But when there is no audience, it can be quite difficult to get into that mindset. You know, from a rehearsal where, yeah, of course, no one would be there, to then a concert, but there's still no one there. Mm. You haven't got that change. So, yeah, you have to kind of, I don't know, find it in yourself. You just have to think of all the people watching it. But, yeah, I mean, if I do choose to take some positives from it, then, I mean, thankful that I get a chance to still do some concerts and maybe we're reaching a different or larger audience than we maybe would have done before.
You said that your practice had changed a bit in terms of, I guess, you're not practicing for a piece for a performance. How has your practice changed over the course of lockdown?
Because I didn't have music to prepare, I used that time to go back to the fundamental stuff, all of the technique, which I know that a lot of students, whenever I talk to them about technique and practicing scales and long terms, they kind of groan, like, oh, yeah.
Glaze over.
And you know what, actually, I wonder if I was a little bit like that when I was a kid until I went to study with Sabina Meyer and she changed all of that for me. I was very young when I went to study with her. I think it was about 11 or 12, 12. And she agreed to be my teacher, but on one condition, which was that I went back to basics. And I kid you not, for 3 hours a day for what felt like a long time, probably 3 weeks, 4 weeks, I did nothing but long notes. And I know people think, oh, that sounds like the stuff of nightmares. And at the time, actually, I just wanted to play music. I just wanted to do the fun stuff. And I guess I didn't really realize the benefits of doing that. The other thing is as well, those fundamental things, we don't notice an improvement straight away. So that kind of, it's hard for your motivation. But you are always making progress. But after a while, then you start noticing the benefits. And I would say, hand on heart, and this is a fairly bold statement, but I don't think I'd have a career in music, certainly in the same way, had I not studied with her. She changed my playing entirely. But over the years after that, yes, of course, you know, we spend time on technique, but with a focus sometimes more on music. So I use this time to really go back to basics and do that. And also brush up even more on the old jazz theory side of things, which, I mean, is a whole nother world.
In the mystical before times, did you attend many live performances as an audience member?
I was speaking to someone about this the other day, and they were asking me about performances. And when you are often, it sounds terrible, often the performances you attend are the ones that you're in, and then you sit in the hall and listen afterwards. And it's there often wasn't enough as much time to just go and enjoy a concert, and I'd always wanted to do that much more. And I guess the ones I had gone to more was a lot more jazz concerts. Often my friends or other band members would be playing in different settings. So I'd go along and spend a lot of time at Ronnie Scott's or Kansas Smithies, which is another incredible jazz club in London. And yeah, spend some time there and hang out. But no, nowhere near as much as I would want to. And I always, if possible... I know some soloists that they'll do the concerto and then they'll be gone. They'll be out as quick as you can. And it depends. If you've got somewhere, you've got to travel somewhere else or a long drive, often you a 4-hour drive or whatever, then I understand it. But I would always try and stay and listen, especially if it was great repertoire as well. Because you know what? The other thing, talking about piano earlier, the other thing that I'd always been into, especially as I got older, was conducting. And I'd always kind of, even now, wonder, I think, should I start looking into it? And I had a chance to be in front of an orchestra for a day. And it was, yeah, I was nervous for the first time in my life. I stood there with this baton. Like, what do you mean? What do I do? And it's just to just show it. And the conductor is a great friend of mine, Michael Seal. And he said, just show. And before that, actually, we hadn't really had much. He gave me the basics, the pointers, but not a huge lesson in conducting. And I stood in front of this orchestra. He's like, just show the music. And I loved it. It was so much fun. Anyway, so I'd always kind of been fascinated. And I'm wary of just trying to conduct without a lot of practice and a lot of dedication. But I always like listening to the second half to firstly hear new repertoire I haven't heard, or a lot of repertoire I have heard, but the interpretation of that particular conductor or the orchestra and the combination.
Are there any that stand out to you in your memory, either that you've played in a segment of or that you've just attended as an audience member, that stand out to you in your memory?
I do remember when I was a kid going quite a lot to see opera productions at the Royal Albert Hall. And they do such an amazing... And the productions they would put on were incredible. I remember seeing Madame Butterfly on a number of occasions, and you know they turn the whole in the round into a water garden, and it was like captivating. It was incredible. You know, one that really does stand in my memory, and because it was incredible, I had played a concert with the CBSO Youth Orchestra with Michael Seal conducting, and we'd done Lindbergh Clarinet Concerto in the first half, which, that's a workout. That's a tough thing. Ooh, like 27 minutes of everything you've got. I mean, it's like someone has to come on stage and carry you off because you're like a shell of a person. You're just completely, you're done. In the second half, they did the Alpine Symphony. And I thought, beforehand, I saw it on the program, I thought, Youth Orchestra doing the Alpine Symphony, that's a brave one. And it was incredible. It was one of the best performances of that piece I've ever seen. Because there is something with a youth orchestra. There is a difference. People try and quantify what it is, but I don't know, exuberance or just the way they play is kind of different as established orchestras. And they just put everything into it. And it was like an electrifying performance. And that's one I will always remember. I mean, also being kind of bowled over that these were young people playing seriously well. Any number of times I've had the pleasure of being at Ronnie Scott's to hear bands play there, or even some of the jam sessions, and you have these people that stand up and just kind of captivate the whole room. But yeah, I do want to.
Well, before I let you go and get on with your day, we'll bring it back into like the present day. Is there anything that you're listening to at the moment that you're obsessed with, or anything that's really that you can't stop listening to?
There's well, these days my musical taste is kind of eclectic. So there's everything from the traditional, the normal, in inverted commas, classical music, like the core repertoire, all the way through jazz, and then a lot of I've always loved the kind of funk soul R&B era. I mean, you know, like Tower Power, Earth, Wind & Fire. I mean, that's great. Awesome music. But then all the way through to, you know, some bands and even some kind of really heavy stuff, heavy metal as well. So that's how wide it is. So I do listen. Depends on the mood I'm in as to what I put on. But I think because I've been recording from home, I've been trying to find or thinking about other recordings that I could do and other arrangements that I could make to then either do a multi-track project here or something I could record remotely with somebody else. So a lot of that, I guess you could sort of call it the more minimalist side of things, or the progressive, classical progressive minimalism. That sort of, is it a genre on its own? I guess I've been listening to more. So yeah, Steve Reich, Philip Glass, composer Graham Fitkin, that also wrote some awesome music. So I guess more in that kind of world and just trying to use the streaming services that we have to discover new things, trying to do that a lot more. And I mean, like the Philip Glass etudes, the piano etudes, they're awesome. And I hadn't, to be honest, I hadn't heard them before.
I ask quite a lot of people this because I feel like it's quite a revealing question. If you were to check your phone right now and see what the last thing you're playing on your streaming app of choice, what is it?
Well, let's have a look. The last thing I played, well, one of the last things I played was Earth, Wind & Fire, the best artist, D'Angelo, Oscar Peterson. There's a lot of Oscar Peterson in there. And then after that, it kind of goes a little bit more further afield to... Yeah, the Prodigy and all sorts of other stuff. I think it's good. You know what? Some people have said to me in the past, it hasn't happened for a while, but I remember one person who said years ago that as a classical musician, you should only listen to classical music. And I thought that was the most ridiculous, absurd statement anybody could ever make. Why? Why? I mean, it all comes from the same thing. So much of music all stems from the same roots, that why not? And to me, if it's good, if the musicianship is good and I enjoy it, of course that's all subjective, then yeah, I'm going to listen to it. Doesn't matter what the genre is. And you can take inspiration, I think, from a lot of different genres and different types of music. I know I saw recently a video of a clarinetist playing I think it was a guitar solo to a heavy metal track on the clarinet. I thought, that is awesome. That's, why didn't I think of that? So, I mean, I'm not suggesting we go and do concerts like that, but just even just for yourself. Yeah. So I think it's important that we keep expanding our musical, our listening horizons, to use that word.
Amazing. Well, I think that is plenty for us to be getting on with. So thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you.
That was Julian Bliss talking to me from his home via Zoom. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Do let us know what you think by rating and reviewing it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're also available in print and various digital formats across the world. Or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read about all the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. Thanks to Acast for hosting and Brittany Colley for producing.